one would try and identify a theme of Tisha B'Av. So there are many themes that one could point to, but certainly the theme of Golus, usually translated as exile, would be an accurate description of that which we call our attention to on Tisha B'Av. Usually we think of exile, so we think of Jews being driven out of their land, out of Eretz Yisrael. We think of the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, and that's not inaccurate. However, we'll notice that there was another form or another type of exile as well. Midrashic tradition, literature, the Medrash, speaks of four Golios, four exiles in the overall history of the Jewish people. There's Golos Bavel, Mitzrayim actually was Golos too, but that was before the Jews were really ever in Eretz Yisrael, so we'll leave that out of this calculation. There's Golos Mitzrayim, the exile in Egypt. There's Golos Bavel, the exile in Babylonia. That was the Babylonians who destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash in what the historians assume is the year 586 BCE, Tisha B'Av of that year. It's recorded in Tanakh, the end of the book of Melachim Beis and Sukkim and Yirmiyahu, referred to the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash in Tisha B'Av. Again, the secular historians assume, and many Jewish historians agree, it's not our topic now, that the year was 586 BCE. That's Golos Bavel. That kind of flowed into Golos Modai, because the Babylonian Empire was taken over by the Persian and Median Empire. We're familiar with Modai from Megillas Esther, Chael, Poras, and Modai, Malchi, Poras, and Modai. So the Babylonian Empire fell to the Empire of the Persians and the Medians, and Ahasuerus ruled over Poras and Modai, among other provinces. And that's the second Golos. Then there's what's called Golos Yavon, the Greeks. We're familiar from Hanukkah. And then there's Golos Edom, which is associated with the Romans. The Roman exile, that's the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, which took place in the year 70 of the Common Era. The Romans destroyed the second Beis HaMikdash since that exile, which we're still in now. So those are the four Golios, the four events, or the four eras, described as eras of Golos. Now, we were playing a game with younger children in school, so we asked which one of these is not like the other. So one would, upon reflection, notice that Golos Yavon seems to be different. Because whereas the Babylonians destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash and drove the Jews out of Eretz Yisrael, Golos Modai, again, was outside of Eretz Yisrael in Persia. The Golos Edom, outside of Eretz Yisrael, the Roman exile. Golos Yavon, what do you mean Golos Yavon? The Jews were in Eretz Yisrael. The Beis HaMikdash was standing. Yes, it was defiled, and we know again from the Hanukkah story, but they weren't in Golos, were they? They were in Eretz Yisrael. True, they didn't have a political autonomy, certainly not complete political autonomy, but still, if we stop and think for a moment, it would appear to us to be strange to refer to that Golos as Golos, because again, the Jews lived in Eretz Yisrael, and the Beis HaMikdash stood and functioned. What you see from there, then, is that Golos is not only, it's not a word that's used only to describe the absence of the Jews from Eretz Yisrael and the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, but the fact that it can be Golos, they can be exiled in Eretz Yisrael as well. And I'd like to look at in this presentation a number of examples, a couple from what I might turn to the ancient history, past history, and a couple, or at least one, some detail from more modern history, where we see a type of Golos affecting the Jews in Eretz Yisrael, Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, perhaps even under Jewish sovereignty in Eretz Yisrael, and yet it's still Golos. And that Golos is typified, unfortunately, by Jew versus Jew, a lack of understanding, lack of tolerance, different approaches, one could argue, and I'm not going to make political statements here, but that the different positions are l'shem shamayim, if not from the religious point of view, but from the political point of view. Both sides, or all the sides, are doing what they feel is right, what they feel is best for the Jewish people, but sometimes the arguments and the disagreements become harsh, become bloody, become tragic, and hence the term Golos for those events as well. One can, if one wants, point to the very, very beginning of Jewish history when such a tragedy happened. If we focus upon the story mentioned a couple of years ago in context of Pharaoh Gemalchus, the story of Yosef and his brothers. Right? And that's the first, that's the beginning of Golos, you know. The Medrash tells us that when Yaakov Avinu came back successfully from his time with his uncle Lavan in, you know, the other part of the country, the other part of the, across the river, Aram Naraim, Lavan. So the pasuk says, "Vayeshev Yaakov, Yaakov dwelled," and the Chazal Kanan Dikesh Yaakov Leishev B'Shalva. Yaakov wanted to dwell in relative peace and comfort, and Chazal understand that Yaakov thought that's it. The exile is over. This is before Egypt, let's remember. But he had been in exile, living and having to suffer under his uncle Lavan. And so Yaakov thought, Chazal tell us, when he came back to Eretz Yisrael, now the Jewish people in their land was going to develop and evolve, and they didn't get the Torah, they'd get the Beis Hamikdos, whatever was supposed to happen. The Mashiach died back then in the days of Yaakov. Now you'll ask me, yeah, but wasn't Avram told that his descendants would be enslaved for 400 years? That was the Bris Ben Absarim. Avram Avinu had already been told, the covenant. Earlier, Yaakov's grandfather, Abraham, was told that they'd be suffering for 400 years. How could Yaakov even think that after 22 years that he spent in the house of love and that was it? Well, and come up with answers. Truth is, you have to come up with answers because the Jews weren't in Egypt for 400 years either. They were in Egypt for 210 years. So you have to figure out what happened to the other 190. You can figure out the Jews were in Egypt for 210 years. I thought Avram was told 400 years. You have to figure out, well, HaKadosh Baruch Hu took them out early and all kinds of reasons. Perhaps you've had the discussion at the Pesach Seder, you know, different reasons how the Chishon is a case, because Baruch took off 190 years, case, the Kuf Tzadi, it took off 190 years. But however we work that out, so we'll work this out. Not for now. But Yaakov, Vikesh Yaakov, Leish, and Shalom. So Soloveitchik always says, what do you mean Yaakov wanted to dwell in peace? He's going to retire. He thought now he can sit back, get himself a rocking chair, and read the paper. Well, you know, what was going to be Leish, and Shalom? No, it means that he thought that this was going to be, you know, the destiny of the Jewish people right here and now. What went wrong? Guess what? Rav Soloveitchik pointed out, he may have been right. He could have possibly been right. But the story of Yosef and his brothers, and that changed the whole of Jewish history. Yosef was sold by his brothers, eventually went down to Egypt, and there was a famine. They had to come down. You all know the story. So that was perhaps the beginning of exile. That's Jews in Eretz Yisrael. Now, Yosef was a good person, the brothers were good people. So what exactly happened here? So we're not analyzing Chumash now, but on a simple level, they had different visions, different views as to what the role, how the Jewish people should be. Yosef had one view, the brothers had another view. The brothers were nervous. Besides the fact that Yosef strikes us perhaps a little bit of a brat, at least in his early years, you know, ratting in his brothers, according to the Midrash and so on. But the brothers had a legitimate fear. You know, in the previous two generations, there were also brothers, not as many, but there were also brothers. One was chosen and one was rejected. So Avram had Yitzchak, but he had Yishmael. Right? So Yitzchak was chosen and Yishmael was rejected, at least in terms of the destiny of the Jewish people. In the next generation, it was Yaakov. Yitzchak had Yaakov and he had Esau. Yaakov was chosen and Esau was rejected. It was not beyond the realm of logic for the brothers of Yosef to think, well, wait a second. So maybe in this generation it's going to be the same thing. One guy is going to be chosen, that's Yosef, he's the favorite son, and the rest of us are the rejected ones. They didn't want any part of that. So on one level, just a way to understand the dynamics, worth thinking about. But also, other Mefarshim pointed out that Yosef had one view, the brothers viewed themselves, the dream, the brothers viewed themselves as shepherds, and they thought that that was their destiny. And here was Yosef was having dreams about stars and the sun, the moon, you know. It was a different way of life, a different way of thinking. There's much to say about that beyond the scope of what I want to present right now. But that's the beginning. Perhaps that's one, that's the Golos in Eretz Yisrael. Like a look, as I say, at maybe four things, two from ancient history and two, or maybe two or three from ancient history, and another two from more modern history, at least in brief, and one in great detail. And one is, in the very early history of the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael, following the establishment of a monarchy. Those who know the history know that David HaMelech established the Malchus Beis David. He was succeeded by his son Shlomo, who built the first Beis HaMikdash, and ruled over a large amount of territory, was at peace with his neighbors, and things looked real good. In the next generation, disaster. the kingdoms split. So you had, from then on, until the Korban on Tisha B'Av in 586 BCE, you had two kingdoms. Actually, the first kingdom disappeared before the Korban. But for a long time, you had two, several centuries, you had two kingdoms. You had what's known as the Northern Kingdom, because they were in the north, and the Southern Kingdom in the south. The Northern Kingdom is often called Malchus Yisrael, and the Southern Kingdom is called Malchus Yehuda. The Northern Kingdom are the 10 tribes, and the Southern Kingdom are the 2 tribes. That doesn't mean that there wasn't anybody from one tribe, you know, it doesn't mean everyone was evenly divided or whatever. You may have had somebody from one tribe living down here, but for the most part, the Northern 10 tribes, the Malchus Yisrael, and you had the Malchus Yehuda. How'd that come about? So that came about, and the split was engineered to a great extent by a fellow by the name of Yerovam ben Nevat. Yerovam goes down in infamy, identified the mission Sanhedrin as one of the people who forfeits, according to one of his, forfeited his share in all Abba. Every Jew has a share in all Abba, and Yerovam is one of the people who don't. And he's known as the held up as the example of Chotei Machtias Arabim. He not only sinned, but he inspired others to sin. The great villain in Jewish history. Yerovam was not an idiot. Yerovam was not a person to be reckoned with. Yerovam was not a person who was potentially a great person. In fact, the idea that the kingdoms would split and that Yerovam would rule over one of the kingdoms was told him by none other than Novi, Yachya Shiloni. A Novi told him. And if you can look this up, this is in Noachim Aleph and Perek Yudei. You can read it yourself again in Tisha B'Av, so you don't really have Talmud Torah in that sense, but just I'll point you to it. Take 10 minutes to read it, and you see the story that Yerovam was approached by Achia HaShiloni, the Navi at that time, a Navi at that time, who ripped his garments into 12 pieces and told him, you take 10, and the Malchus Beis David's going to hold on to 2. So it was divinely ordained. Now what was the point of the, what moment was the split? So Shlomo had a son, his successor, was a gentleman by the name of Rechavam. And Rechavam, the son of Shlomo, ended up with the 2 tribes, and Yerovam ended up with the other 10. Who was this Yerovam? The Gemara says in one place, in Sanhedrin of Kuvbeis, Torosos Yerovam lohayav ashun dofi. I don't say that about everybody. Yerovam's Torah had no blemish. Was an intelligent person, a learned person. Yerovam was not some rabble-rouser, some empty-headed troublemaker. Yerovam was a man who was talented. However, he was also, the same Gemara tells us, the same Perek in Sanhedrin, he was also Meriva Ba'am. He caused a great quarrel among the Jewish people, Uben Yisrael Avim Sheba Shamayim. He caused a quarrel between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What was in the Kuda? What was the point that we're going to separate everything? How did Yerovam get into this business in the first place? A disagreement with Shlomo HaMelech. Yerovam was around before he became the king. And known as a talented person, he had a disagreement with Shlomo. Because Shlomo HaMelech stopped up some of the entryways. You know, I'm trying to think of examples where they, you know, can imagine if they went ahead and put on Route 4, they put a toll plaza up. So they'd have to drive on Route 4 and have to pay a toll every day. Now, people wouldn't go with that in a big way, right? It's a free street and all of a sudden there's a toll. People like to get rid of tolls. Once in a while there's good news, they take a toll away. But for the most part, they put tolls. There's even a highway in Eretz Yisrael now. On Highway 6, a toll road. Right? So people, rubs people the wrong way. So Shlomo HaMelech needed some income. The cynic said that because he had to support his many wives, especially the daughter of Pharaoh, whom he married, in the style which he was accustomed, so he needed more income. So he set up the King Shlomo Thruway, whatever he might have called it. And it was a toll road. But David HaMelech had opened Jerusalem. He wanted the walls open so that people could come when they wanted to, especially in the Ola Rego, coming this way to make it accessible. And Shlomo says to be accessible, you have to pay a toll. So Yerovam gave him a hard time. What kind of business is this? Your father set this up in such a way to encourage Jews to come to Yerushalayim, to encourage us to come in to this direction, that direction, gates and openings, and you're charging so you can keep yourself in, you know, living the high life, so to speak. Yerovam was a shame Shemayim in that regard, sticking up for the Jewish people. Things got worse under Rechavam, because Rechavam decided to raise the taxes. I think they had taxes under Shlomo, he made more taxes. And we see there a dispute between Rechavam's advisors. The elder advisor said, no, you better not add a tax, you better take away taxes. I don't know if you hear that in American politics too, right? I'm going to raise taxes. I'm not going to raise taxes. This is an old problem. So Rehavam raises the taxes. And at some point, the Jewish people say, I can't. We're not paying these exorbitant taxes. And Rehavam makes a comment about his own father, which is disparaging about his father. He's in my father. I'm nothing compared. He's nothing compared to me. Rehavam started off as a hero, right? Different views. Now, Shlomo HaMelech had good reasons for his government setup, for his tax setup. After all, he was at peace. I'm not dealing with the issue now. I have so many wives and marriages. But Shlomo was the king who was not at war. He built the Beis HaMikdash because he was not a warrior. David was not permitted to build the Beis HaMikdash. So Shlomo had a vision. Rehavam had a vision. Rehavam had a different vision. Many Jewish people had a different vision. Who's right and who's wrong? Not for us to sit and say, one's right and one's wrong. There were different approaches, but things deteriorated. And so, when Jeroboam was in power, he recognized that he's going to have his power in the northern kingdom, but they're going to come to Yerushalayim to bring Karbanos and the holidays. Their allegiance will still be in Yerushalayim. So he set up idols in two places in the northern kingdom. Now the Rishonim disagree, the Gemara and Sanhedrin, Rashi, Adama, different Rishonim disagree, and the Gemara and Sanhedrin, some say with the same Shemayim there too, didn't really mean them as idols. Those who studied the Parsha of the Egel Azov, no, that many commentaries tell us that in the time of the Golden Calf, they weren't really worshipping the idols, it was just a means of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Then the Rishonim would say the same thing about Yerovam. And Yerovam also sent soldiers to prevent Jews from coming to Yerushalayim, and one thing led to the other, and you had Golos and Eretz Yisrael. You had, if you read throughout the second half of Melachim Aleph and all of Melachim Beis, two parallel kingdoms, sometimes at war with each other, sometimes allying themselves with the enemy of one to fight the other. Those Jews joined up with whoever the neighborhood bully was in that time to go fight against the other side. This was already after Yerovam was gone, but the subsequent generation, the subsequent times, there was never a unified Jewish people ever again. These 10 lost for 10 northern tribes became known in literature now, as the 10 lost tribes. They got lost because they were defeated by Sanherib, the king of Assyria, Melech Ashur, about 150 years before the Churban of the first Beit HaMikdash. The king of Ashur invaded the land, defeated the so-called northern kingdom, that was the end of them, took them off into exile. We don't know what became of them. An interesting shear in its own right to try and figure out who the Tajistu was. Just in Eretz Yisrael, I had the privilege to be there for a couple of weeks, right? You know, in Eretz Yisrael, I was davening a minyan, walking to shul. So there's some old fellow there that says, he just published a couple of books, but I like to look at it. I don't know how he knew to ask me that question, but he did. So the one thing that's interesting to me, he wrote about the 10 tribes. I was picked it up, was reading on a plane, so maybe another year we'll talk about it. But it's an interesting subject. What happened to the 10 lost tribes? How did they get lost? Who are they? There were kinds of theories who they are even today. You know, there are remnants of them around. But there was never again a unified Jewish people. And so we have this situation where different approaches and different viewpoints led to a really disaster or tragedy for the Jewish people, never a united kingdom again. Was Yerovam a bad person? Well, yes, he goes down in history as such. But his motivations, again, we've shown him right this in Sanhedrin. Some of his motivations, I'll call upon him, will shame Shemayim, what he thought was the best for Klal Yisrael. Can have different views, but those views, when they come to hatred, when they lead to disagreement and sin, are a recipe for disaster. That's exile in Eretz Yisrael, Jew versus Jew. That kind of hatred and that kind of lack of unity is a form of exile, even though you're in Eretz Yisrael, even though there's a Beis HaMikdash. Let's fast forward now a little bit to the period of the Bayis Sheni, the second Beis HaMikdash. I referred before to Golos Yavon, right? That we know from the Hanukkah story. So again, from the time we were little children, we learned first about the Hanukkah, whatever it was, we first learned about the Hanukkah story. So the great villain in Hanukkah is Antiochus. Happens to be that this young man, your little kid, but the number of the rulers there were Antiochus. He was Antiochus the IV, known as Antiochus Epiphanes, the official title. Now, just to clarify, I've mentioned this in the past, but it bears repetition because people are always confused about it. You know, sometimes you read a history book and who are the enemies in Hanukkah anyway? So you hear about the Greeks and the Syrian Greeks and the Greek Syrians and who, you know, like, who are they? What do you mean the Syrian? Syria is not Greece and Greece is not Syria. So how do you get the Syrian Greeks? what's going on exactly. But just for clarification purposes, when Alexander the Great Greek Empire, when the Greek Empire, when Alexander the Great died, his successors were not able to hold on to a consolidated empire. So his Greek Empire under Alexander the Great was eventually divided into three parts, and subsequently into two parts. One part was based in Egypt, in a city called Alexandria, named for him. The other was based in Damascus, in Syria. So, hence the Syrian Greeks, right? It was the Greek Empire, but it was a portion of the Greek Empire that was based in Syria. So you had one empire, one portion of the empire. They weren't united. They were sometimes enemies. You had one portion of the empire in Syria, another portion of the empire in Egypt. As an aside, what's in between Egypt and Syria? The Jews are always in the middle, right? So that's just that's part of it. That's like the Middle East, right? We're always in the middle of everything. So, but in any event, these are two different empires. So the enemy Hanukkah time, the kings of the of what's called the Seleucid Empire, the empire based in Damascus, were often called Antiochus, just like all the kings in France are called Louis. So in ancient times also, a lot of the kings had the same name. So this is Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes. Now we know about the decrees, you know, from the time we have songs, we learn a little kid, no Rosh Chodesh, and no Shabbos, and no Bris Milah. So he's the great villain, and that's who the Maccabees were fighting against. My daughter was kind enough to share an article with me from a historian by the name of Elias Vickerman. This is originally written in German. I'll have the English version here. And it appears in the Jewish Expression from Yale University Press, 1977. We had an interesting group of questions that sort of challenge our understanding, our traditional understanding, and it gives us a different insight. The truth of the matter is, we rarely find that, at least in those days, that religious persecution is the theme of the day in terms of trying to get people to convert. That's a later kind of thing. Like you don't have evidence, for example. There's no question, again, that leaders, tyrants, sometimes abuse and are horrible to their subject. That's not the issue. Okay. However, he has evidence that King Antiochus was not interested necessarily in eliminating religious diversity. In fact, and he documents here, I'm not going to read all of it inside, but he documents that, you know, a number of different faith communities were under the control of this Antiochus, the Antiochus of Hanukkah, and nowhere do we find against any of them decrees. You know, Muslims, and there were no Muslims then, but there were others, you know, the Arabs of that time were not Muslims, but they practiced Bris Milah as well. Right, the descendants of Yishmael, the descendants of Yishmael practiced circumcision too. We don't find that those Yishmaelites, whatever exactly they were, those Arabs at that time, who were living in the same empire under Antiochus, were victimized by decrees against circumcision. So why were the Jews? Why was that a big thing? No Hanukkah. It was a big thing. No Bris Milah. All of a sudden the Jews, and there were other religion communities, faith communities, which were under the same empire, the same Greek tyrant, and they weren't subjected to the same types of religious coercion. They weren't forced, as the Jews were, to worship idols, or to eat pork, and to sacrifice pigs, and so on. The question, therefore, is a strong question. Why was it that he carried things out this way? And not only that, but he demonstrates that even other Jews living in Eretz Yisrael, not in Yerushalayim, not in the center, were also not subjected to these very same decrees. So it's a very localized and very individualized type of persecution, which would seem, therefore, to point in the direction that he was not interested in winning over the whole country to his religious beliefs. It wasn't as such a firm guy, so he wanted to go be Makarot everybody by force or by other ways. That wasn't the situation. So why is it that the Jews were subject to the decrees of Hanukkah time? So he goes on in this essay to demonstrate that it's because of Jews themselves. There were many Jews who were greatly attracted to the Greek culture. You know, in the earlier time, a couple of generations before, the Torah was translated into Greek. We call that the Septuagint, or the Targum Shivim. Now that was commissioned by a leader of the Greek Empire based in Egypt, and one of the Ptolemies. The kings of the north were called Antiochus, and the ones in the Egyptian branch of the empire were called Ptolemies. So I think it's Ptolemy II. The Gemara calls him Ptolemy Amela. Gemara Megillah? Ptolemy Amela. So we know the stories. The Gemara reports that he he corralled 70 rabbis and put them in 70 different rooms, telling them to translate the Torah, and there are certain passages in the Torah which can be viewed as offensive to someone who doesn't believe in it, so they altered a little bit, and it was a great miracle because they all made the same alteration. They all came out with the exact same translation despite being in 70 different rooms. Somebody, I think, her name of Huttner, as a homeworker, once quipped, they think that was a miracle, so it would have been a bigger miracle if all the rabbis were in the same room, and they came out with the translation. But be that as it may, this was the so-called Targum Shiva. Now the Gemara says that this was a moment of darkness. As a matter of fact, it's conceivable that there was a Tainus, we don't observe that Tainus today, but there was a Tainus Tzadikim on a day that happened around the 10th of Tevez. Asar B'Tevez, we have a Tainus Rodri. You look in the Slichas of Asar B'Tevez, there's a reference to the translation, and look in the Shulchan Aruch, there's a connection to the fact that the Targum, that the Torah was translated to Greek. What's so bad about that? Now, why is it so bad to translate the Torah into Greek? There are many points. It takes away the Jews' soul connection to it and so on. But there's something else that legitimizes the Greek language, because now, after all, the Torah is in Greek too. And once you legitimize the Greek language, so then it's not a tremendous leap to legitimize the Greek culture and to legitimize other things that relate to the Greeks and so on. So therefore, there were many Jews who were what we called Hellenists, who were following or beginning to accept and to adhere to and to find attractive. You know, it's really the first time, I think we've spoken other times, it's really the first time in history. We don't find, for example, that the Jews in Babel were terribly impressed with the Babylonian culture. Now, we don't find they were impressed with the Persian culture. I guess there just wasn't that much that was exciting for them about it. But the Greek culture was impressive. We don't have to demonstrate that. We know that Greek poetry, Greek drama, literature, architecture, still studied today. As you go to architecture school, you go to architecture school, you're going to read about Greek columns and so on and so forth. And Greek drama and Greek poetry, you study literature, so it's, you know, they invented the plays and so on and so forth. So there was a lot that was attractive. So many Jews began to be attracted. They began to view their own religion, Yiddishkeit, as old-fashioned, barbaric, right? They were the reformers of their time. You had different Jews. Now these Jews, are they bad people? They had a different vision for Jewish history. They felt that the right thing, the way to survive, the way to be successful, is to try and, yes, keep basic Jewish beliefs, but assimilate a little bit into the culture. Let's take what the society has to offer us. We don't have to figure out the minutia of every little law, like every single little din that appears in a small sifkot in the Shulchan Aruch. Yes, certain basic beliefs. Well, we can alter. We can change certain things and still be, and therefore be accepted by the society. And so what you really had at the time of Hanukkah were Jews fighting Jews. The Hashmonaim, the Maccabim, were those who stood and stayed strong with the basics of all of our religious traditions. There's an interesting quote here. He said that the Jewish Hellenists attributed the misfortunes of their people to its habit of isolation. Right? You know why the Jews are persecuted so much? Because, you know, we're always different. We can't do this, we can't do that, we don't want to go here, we don't want to do that. See, after a while, the people don't like you. You can never make it, right? And that's what the Haman said, that the Chazal tell us. You know, every time something comes up, it's Shabbos, it's Yom Tov, it's Erev Shabbos, it's Erev Yom Tov, it's Motzei Yom Tov. No, we can never do anything. Right? So this was the complaint that non-Jews had. And there's basis to it. And so these guys, I'm reading here again, he said, it was in this spirit that the Jewish Hellenists attributed the misfortunes of their people to its habit of isolation. Perhaps the most grievous gap in our knowledge of the Maccabean period, we do not know the nature of the many evils from which the reformers hoped to rescue Jews. Right? They wanted to rescue Jews from whatever it was. They wanted to be like other people. They even eliminated the traits of circumcision in order to appear as Greeks, even naked. Right, that was the had operations and so on, because they wanted to be like the Greeks, but as a means of integrating into society. And of course, there are other Jews who strongly disagreed. And as these disagreements took force, it became battles, became fighting. For the sake of tolerance. And for the sake of trying to show that, you know, we're all good people, so a lot of blood was spilled. Right? This happened during that time as well. And so, the group of Jews described in the Book of Maccabees and so on, who were interested in this, got a lot of followers. Broad sectors of the population joined the Reform Party out of opportunism or fear. Right? The Maccabees were fighting primarily against these apostates. The unrest began when Matisyo killed the Jews as he was about to become the first in Modi'in, that's where he lived, right, to sacrifice the idols. That's what started it. It wasn't the Greek army, it wasn't Antiochus' forces. Antiochus liked the idea of Jews who were interested in following his culture, and then subsequently passed certain decrees and so on, but the trouble was started by Jews. And indeed, a good part of the battles that took place, that we know from Hanukkah, were the battles of the Jews who wanted to stick strong to our tradition, the others who reformed but had good reasons in mind. Now, this is from this article over here. I wasn't aware of this article when my daughter brought it to my attention, but Rav Soloveitchik, as I was aware of, has quoted the Sefer Nefesh HaRav under, the second one, Pnimei HaRav under Hanukkah, makes the about all these sources in the Book of Maccabees and so on, whether you knew it or not, says, Ze alpayim shono sha'am yisrael chogeg es Hanukkah. Hanukkah, but rak ma'atim yikir, it's almost more than a chorosh of Hanukkah, says. For thousands of years, Jews have been celebrating Hanukkah, but not that many people know what really happened. He said, there's a small gemara, a little bit about it, not much. He's been made by Yishenu Amdu HaYehudim B'fnei Shnei Oivim. Jews had two enemies, and one of the enemies were Jews themselves. And he says that when we say in Al-Hanisim, Rabin B'Agnatim, you know, Tmeim B'Torah, Mishon B'Atarikim, he's talking about Jew versus Jew. He wasn't talking about the Greeks. He says, Nusach Al-Hanisim B'Gam Loshem Rav Loshem Tzadi Nohar. The gemara speaks in euphemism. The gemara is embarrassed to record that it was Jew versus Jew, so it's presented in a way, you know, Kishonda, Malchus Yovah HaRashah, Alam Ho Yisrael HaShichem Torah Secha. But that's not, Amil in the Tzir is not Midas HaSalvesh, you can look it up. Amil's page, Yekuf Mem Hei, in this volume, it's Nei Hara, on the Hanukkah, Likut and Hagus. Amil in the Tzir is Al-Nisim, Shonda, Malchus Yovah HaRashah, Eil Mechumonos, Laivonim HaGoyim, El Laihudim HaMisyadmim, Shabbatu Medosom. It's really talking about the Jews who rejected the religion. Zot ha'pam ha'rishon v'gam ha'chon ha'sherol ha'yehudim nirul ha'dosam. Most Jews abandoned Judaism. Amnam ha'yukrutzos k'tanos, with small groups and so on and so forth. So the same idea written again from obviously a different perspective. So this too, now we understand maybe why it's called Golos Yavon. It was Golos, the word defining Golos is Jew versus Jew. This too was Jew versus Jew. With these wicked people, yes, we consider them such because they abandoned Torah principles. But they did it because they thought this was the right way for Klal Yisrael. To fast forward a little further to the next Tisha B'Av, the second Tisha B'Av, actually we include them around the third, the second destruction, the second Beis HaMikdash, in the year 70 of the Common Era. So there's a revolt that took place, you know, again, you know the history, it wasn't just the Romans walked in one day and destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, it was part of an ongoing series of battles. Yerushalayim was besieged. Yerushalayim was controlled by Jews, but it wasn't controlled by a unified group of Jews. There were at least three different groups of Jews, right? There were the so-called Friends of Rome, and there were the Zealots, and you had the Sikrikin, the wise guys, you know, the bandits, the tough guys, and then you had the Prushim and the Tzukim. You had all kinds of different groups, at least three principal groups vying for control of Yerushalayim, arguing about what is the best path for the Jewish people at this time. There were those who took the approach, it's fight to the finish. We give up for nothing. And we're going to fight the Romans, and if it means we all die, we all die. That's the mentality we saw, you know, we know about from Masada. And we're not going to kowtow under any circumstance. We're not going to surrender. A Jew doesn't surrender. I mentioned in the Kinnis this morning that the great Gaon, a leader of Polish Jewry, was killed in the Warsaw Ghetto by the name of Menachem Zemba. We don't have much of his writings of the law. So Menachem Zemba, we have some material on the Chol Shabbos, who was an Erevin, and some Chuvis, but most of his writings of the law. The leader of Polish Jewry in pre-war Europe lived in Warsaw. He was in the Warsaw Ghetto. In fact, he died in the Warsaw Ghetto uprising on Kiddush Hashem. And the story that I read, and again, I'm assuming it's accurate, it's more or less, that many Jews, when they were talking about planning the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, went to Menachem Zemba and asked him, is this a Hatiyalocha? The term of Jews, those who were, you know, who want to seek rabbinic direction on this issue, do we fight? After all, we'll probably get killed. On the other hand, we're going to get killed anyway. So, I mean, is this a good thing? Is not a good thing? They asked Menachem Zemba. And Menachem Zemba said as follows, you know, we speak about Nekama taking revenge usually speak about that as a negative trait, right? The Pasuk Chumash, lo sikom, and I want to take revenge. Mark gives an example, you know, I asked you to, can you lend me such and such an item? And you refuse, so tomorrow when you ask me, but yeah, you can give me yes, I'm not giving it today. Right, that's revenge. On the other hand, we say about a Kadosh Baruch Hu himself is Kael Nekomos Hashem. What we had in the Seder a couple of weeks ago, Kadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe, Nekom Nikmas Bnei Sovei Sanajonim. Take revenge. So which is it? Revenge is good. It's not good. Sometimes, yeah, how do we know? Kael Nekomos Hashem. So Menachem Zemba said that when we're talking about a personal squabble with somebody, a personal disagreement, then it's a bad trait. A guy didn't lend you a cup of sugar, she didn't lend you a cup of sugar, big deal. You're defending your own honor, you can let it go. That's called sikom, don't take revenge. When you're talking about the dignity of Klal Yisrael, and through that, the dignity of our Kodesh Baruch, a different story altogether. That's what Menachem Zemba said, encourage the Wurzel get upright, in which he himself lost his life. Now, you know, they were going to die anyway, so maybe, I'm not saying we should extrapolate from that to any other situation, but it's instructive. So you have the same machokas, the same dispute in the time of the Bayis Sheni. Should we surrender to the Romans? At least we'll stay alive. Or should we fight to the finish? We're talking about Yerushalayim. Now the chief rabbi at the time is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. This is in the Gemara. One of the Gemaras you're permitted to learn on Tisha B'Av. The Gemara says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai decided that the right thing to do is to make peace with the Romans or we're going to lose everything. No point in fighting to the death. It's a lost cause. There's just no way that the Jews are going to overcome the entire Roman army. It's an impossibility. Now, the siege in Yerushalayim, no one's allowed in and out. Jews did not let anyone out. In fact, just to give you an idea, one group of these zealots actually burned the storehouse and destroyed a lot of the food so that people would not, think they didn't want the Romans to get a hold of it, and they wanted to maintain their strong control. They didn't want people leaving and so on, so they kept everybody in under an iron fist. Yochanan ben Zakkai set up a ruse. Many of you know the story. He let word out that he had taken ill, and then he got the word out that he had died. But in the din, we don't bury in Yerushalayim. We don't bury outside Yerushalayim. So Yochanan ben Zakkai was in a coffin, and his two great talmidim, Elazar and Elazar, we know Elazar from the Gemara of Yeshua, and two of the outstanding talmidim of Yochanan ben Zakkai, accompanied his coffin out of Yerushalayim. And, there were people, people smelled the rat, they thought something funny's going on, but whatever it is, Yochanan ben Zakkai got out. And when he was a safe distance away from Yerushalayim, came out of the coffin, and met with the general Vespasian. And he cut a deal with Vespasian. And the deal was, he's going to surrender Yerushalayim. Imagine that. He would give up the Beit HaMikdash. Should we talk today about lands for peace? Should we give this little territory here, this village over there? I'm not weighing in on politics now. Yochanan ben Zakkai gave him Yerushalayim. Now, that's because he thought it was a lost battle. You have to prove that it's a lost battle today. And again, that's not for today's discussion. Although, again, when you have difference of opinion among good people, there's logic to every position. There are Rabbanim, as you know, who say that we should give up. I'm not among them, but there are Rabbanim who say we should give up territory in Eretz Yisrael. Prominent Rabbanim, far more knowledgeable than I. We should give up, and the main thing is peace. And we, have to say something and so on and so forth, give up. What do you mean? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gave up. Okay, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai determined that it was a losing battle. Is it a losing battle today? Maybe it is. That's part of the discussion. But Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai surrendered the Beit HaMikdash. What did he get out of it? Three things. Right? The Jewish leadership, the Torah leadership, was reestablished in Yavne. Saved the Torah. That was the deal. He also saved the family of Rabbi Gamliel, the Nisim, the leaders of the Jewish people. The third thing I mentioned in Kinnis Moni, very interesting, he asked for a doctor, for a tzara, one of the Tanaim, one of the Kohanim, who had been fasting and had gotten ill, which the Rebbe always pointed out, says that even at a time of great national tragedy, you don't lose sight of the individual. It's a theme that comes up in a number of the Kinnis. I point out this one, I'm going to now. That's an important point. We tend to think on Tisha B'Av, I digress for a moment. We tend to think of Tisha B'Av, we focus on the national tragedy. As well we should. We sometimes lose sight of the personal tragedy. People suffer, regular human beings, men, women, children, suffer. And there are kinnis. Kinnis with the story of the young son and daughter of Rabbi Shmuel. The Rav said, why is there kinnis about them? Were they important people? Were they major players? Were they people whose lives shaped the destiny of Jewish people? No. And the Rav said, it doesn't matter. You don't lose sight of individual suffering either. So that's the deal. And Zakah took care of that. But that was the deal. And Yerushalayim fell, but Torah continued. Very interesting. The Gemara records elsewhere that Yochanan ben Zakkai was on his deathbed. He was terribly frightened. He was weeping. And his Talmidim came to him and said, "You know what? Tzadik, Talmachachon, Yochanan ben Zakkai. So what are you worried about? What are you weeping about?" He said, "Well, you know, if I were, I'd be nervous enough by approaching the human being king. You know, who doesn't remember from one day to the next, doesn't even live from one day to the next. But now I'm going to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Oy vey, how can I not be?" What was he upset about? So salvation from Rochel HaDerov and others said that Yochanan ben Zakkai went to his deathbed wondering, did I make the right decision? How do you know? Now, he made the decision that made sense to him. And he saved Torah. But who knows? Maybe, you know, did he give up the Beis HaMikdash? Did he give up Yerushalayim? Yochanan ben Zakkai went to his deathbed not really sure that he had made the decision. So this Golus too was Jew versus Jew. I'm staying away from the issue here of the observant Jews, non-observant Jews. Jews who had different visions, but it turned violent. And people killed each other, and disaster followed. So these are examples from more ancient history. To fast forward now to something more modern history, which is not well known about, as well known about, but should be. And for this segment, I just want to acknowledge the contribution of Rabbi Dr. Schneur Lyman, Professor Schneur Lyman, one of the great Jewish historians of contemporary times, great Talmud Chacham, great scholar. I'm not exactly sure what his official title is. The professor has published many books, and I heard a tape years ago of a lecture of his on this subject, and therefore most of what I say is gleaned from that presentation. It relates to what is known in early State of Israel history as the Arlozorov Affair. I'd like to go into that a little bit and add some things which perhaps are not as well known and don't appear in the regular history books. There was a Rehov Arlozorov in most major cities in Eretz Yisrael. I have to think about this when I was just in Eretz Yisrael. We were walking from one place to another, and we passed Rehov Arlozorov in Yerushalayim. We were walking up Rehov Jabotinsky. It's somewhat an irony of history that Rehov Jabotinsky and Rehov Arlozorov meet, as we'll see shortly, but they do. In Yerushalayim, up the street from the Inbal Hotel, don't you know? So that's Rehov Jabotinsky. If you walk up the street, you'll come to Rehov Arlozorov. There's Rehov Arlozorov in Tel Aviv. Who was Arlozorov? So Arlozorov is a gentleman, Chaim Arlozorov, who was a leader of what's known as the Labor Zionist Movement. The Labor Zionist Movement was the establishment party of Jews. Again, this is in pre-state Israel, history of Israel. Right? The Jews began coming back in large numbers in the late 1800s, the beginning of the Zionist movement among the observant Jews, the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon, Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, Talmidim of the Lubavitcher, the Baal HaTanya, came into Eretz Yisrael, and you had the Yishuv, and you had lots of different views as to what should happen here in Israel. Right? Every view, every group had its own approach. We spoke about it many years ago, spoke about early origins of the Israeli Arab conflict. So there were different views as to what should be. So the establishment party, so to speak, was known as the Labor Zionist Movement. That's the party of Ben-Gurion, and that's the party that eventually, when the state was founded, was the political power in charge, right, of Ben-Gurion, Chaim Weizmann, and that group. So Arlozorov, Chaim Arlozorov, Dr. Chaim Arlozorov, was a member of that party. In fact, he was the leader, he was the head of the political department of the Jewish Agency. And the year we're looking at now is 1933, so this was 15 years before the establishment of the state. So Chaim Arlozorov, again, he was the head of the political department of the Jewish Agency. He had been, remember it's 1933, so things in Germany were just starting, but he had actually met with Hitler and was trying to set up a situation to be able to get the Jews out. They were going to import products to Germany, and German products would come to Israel, and then the whole setup. Anyway, he was trying to make it financially worthwhile for Hitler to let the Jews of Germany out. Again, in 1933, it was least feasible. At least something to talk about. Anyway, the other party, of which Arlozorov was not a member, the opposition party, was known as the Zionist Revisionist Party, or the Chirut Party, and that's the antecedent of today's Likud Party. Right? I mean, that's the party of Menachem Begin, kind of Yitzhak Shamir, and now Netanyahu. I mean, it's removed somewhat from the origin in some ways, but again, that's the party. Right? So you have different, these two are the principal parties in terms of politics. And Encyclopedia Judaica refers to the first party, again, a party that was called the Zionist Revisionist Party. That was Jabotinsky, Vladimir Jabotinsky, of whom Begin was a student, you know, a protege. So it describes what, I mean, time is late, so I'm not going to read, but you can look it up in the Encyclopedia Judaica to figure out what their, online I'm sure, what their platform was. They were somewhat more radical, ready to fight, they didn't want to give in to the Germans, we're going to boycott Germany, and we're going to not allow the British to have the control in Israel to have, we're going to bring in our own people, and have a Jewish army, and Jewish banks, and everything else. So different approaches. And these two parties didn't get along, and there was a lot of tension, a lot of bitterness, and again a question, as the state of Israel is becoming a possibility, at least, of what tone the state was going to take. So on Friday, June 16th, 1933, at about 10:30 in the evening, Dr. Chaim Elozarov was shot to death while going for a walk with his wife along the beaches of Tel Aviv. His wife testified that they were attacked by two men who subsequently ran away. And within a couple of days, two Jews were arrested for having shot Arlozorov. The party of Chaim Elozarov, including Ben-Gurion, believed that this was simply a political assassination. Arlozorov was an up-and-coming star, the head of the political party of the Jewish Agency. This other party was opposed to that party, and so this was a political assassination. And two Jews were arrested. Both were members of the other party, the Herut Party, the Zionist Revisionist Party. Arlozorov at the time was 34 years old, and the two Jews arrested, one was a gentleman by the name of Avrom or Avrosha Stavsky, 27 years old, from the Herut Party, and also subsequently Tzvi Rosenblatt, age 22, also of that party. They were arrested for assassinating Arlozorov. Subsequently, a third man by the name of Abba Achimeir, who was one of the leaders of the Herut Party, was arrested for, being the brains behind the operation, for masterminding the assassination. And these three Jews sat in a British prison. Let's remember that from 1918, following World War I, until 1948, Israel, then called Palestine, was under the British control. It was a British mandate. Again, quickly, for a historical perspective, before World War I, there was, in the Middle East, was, you know, there was no Israel, there was no Syria, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Arab Emirates, you know, this Iraq was a big blob, basically, known as part of the Ottoman Empire. And that's how it was for several centuries. The whole Middle East was under the Ottoman Empire, based in Turkey. That included, you had different tribes and different leaders here and there, but there were no independent countries like we have today, no borders like we have today. After World War I, Ottoman Empire was on the losing side. In World War I, they were on the German side, and so their territory was carved up by the winners, including England and France, and that's when the borders, some of which we're familiar with today, at least some of those borders, in terms of Saudi Arabia and Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, that was all carved out following World War I. So, in Palestine and Israel, the British had this grand idea that they were going to rule the country for 30 years and show the population how to run a country in a modern Western way and so on and so forth. That's the period of the British mandate. Didn't work, by the way. Okay? The British mandate. In any event, so in 1933, these three Jews now are sitting in a prison, in a British prison. Almost the trial went on, and close to a year later, June 8, 1934, Rosenblatt, the so-called second gunman, and Achimeir, the alleged brains behind the operation, were acquitted, were found not guilty, there wasn't sufficient evidence, but Stavsky was sentenced to death, he was found guilty, and was going to be sentenced to hang, which was the punishment for murder. He vociferously protested his innocence. He subsequently appealed the decision to the British High Court of Appeals. And in July of 1934, the conviction was overturned by a panel of three judges, and he was out. The members of the Labour Party, Ben-Gurion included, were furious. They felt this was a miscarriage of justice. They felt that a lot of orchestration had taken place overseas. Jabotinsky wasn't in Israel. He was not allowed. He was a persona non grata in Israel, but he orchestrated Stavsky's defense from Europe. And Ben-Gurion and others felt that this was a terrible thing. It was a lot of false accusations, a lot of hatred. In 1982, Under Menachem Begin, ironically, the Israeli government, the then now state of Israel, 1982, opened up an inquiry, set up a commission. And that's what countries do. It's years later, you know, it's almost 50 years later, they set up a commission to look into the matter. And the commission, too, exonerated these Jews, found them innocent. The leading religious figure in Eretz Yisrael at the time was Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, the great Rav Kook. Rav Kook had met Chaim Elozarov on the Arab Rosh Hashanah prior to his being assassinated. In fact, Elozarov's grandfather was a Rav in Europe who published the Sefer. When Elozarov came to meet Rav Kook, Rav Kook went to his library and pulled the Sefer off the shelf, showed him his grandfather's Sefer. Rav Kook was not a member of either party, needless to say. In February of 1934, Abba Achimeir, who was one of the accused, published an open letter to Rav Kook, asking Rav Kook, how can you remain silent while three Jews are on trial for a crime that we didn't commit? I'll read now from the translation of what Achimeir wrote. If not for the fact that I'm aware that you are a Gadol HaTorah, or even more precisely, that you are the Gadol HaDor, I would not bother to write to you. It is now 8 months that three Jews are the victims of a false accusation of murder. We are the Dreyfus and Bilus of our generation. Those will recall, Dreyfus was the French Jewish official who was accused of treason, and the whole French, probably saw that, I think, also once on Tisha B'Av. Bilus, which I never saw, Mendel Bilus was in Russia, accused of killing a Christian child on the blood libel, that they use his blood for matzah. So the famous trial, there's a semi... Bernard Ballard wrote, what's called The Fixer, wrote that it was based on that, but there are more historical accounts as well. We are the Dreyfus and Bilus of our generation, but we are not in Paris, and we are not in Kiev, we are in Tel Aviv. Why are you silent, Rav Kook? You, the leader of Israel, how will you look at us in the face when one day we will be exonerated, we will be acquitted? In the Bilus case, Rav Yaakov Mazza, the chief rabbi of Moscow, spoke out openly in defense of Bilus. He was not silent. Will you, Rav Kook, remain silent? In Hebrew, Mazza zichron l'vracha lo shatak. Hayishtok, Rav Kook? It's an open invitation of Rav Kook to say something, but Rav Kook didn't. Rav Kook remained silent. On June 8, 1934, when the other two were acquitted and Stavsky was found guilty, Rav Kook stopped being silent. Rav Kook published what they call today a pashtriel. You know, when you go in Meir Sharm and see those signs with the black border around it and all the writing in the middle about all kinds of interesting things. So they're called pashkavilim. What kind of word is pashkavil is a different question. It seems that in Italy someplace, there was something, a statue, some Pasquale, something like that. They used to put signs up, so they named pashkavil, whatever it is. But the Cook published, they call it a broadside in English, right? So Cook published this broadside, this pashkavil, where he said as follows, I, the undersigned, attest to the fact that innocent blood is about to be shed in Jerusalem. I can attest on the basis of my inner conscience that Abraham Stavsky is innocent of the murder charge. The absolute truth known to me rests with the one judge who voted for acquittal, because it was a 3-1 vote. There's a way the system set up, we have two British judges, one Arab judge, one Jewish judge. That was the original, so you know, you can figure out who voted which way. Whoever has a divine spark within himself, Jew or non-Jew, must protest and must do his utmost to rescue Stavsky and must see to it that justice prevails. Rav Kook didn't satisfy himself with Pashkavilim and broadside Yerushalayim. He wrote to Jewish Zionist leaders in America. He wrote to non-Jews. He wrote to the Archbishop of Canterbury and to other non-Jewish leaders, saying and sent telegrams all over. Okay, he wrote to Stephen Wise, the leader of the Zionists in America. You know, danger imminent. Do utmost to rescue Stavsky. He sent to Rabbanim. Now, the members of the opposition party, whose men are those of them killed, reacted strongly and very negatively to Rav Kook. And Rav Kook became the object of derision. They accused him of being a closet member of the opposition party. And let's remember that Rav Kook, this was the end, Rav Kook died just a little more than a year later. Rav Kook died in 1935, in September, the beginning of Elul. This is the Tisha B'Av, 1934. So it's the end of Rav Kook's life. He had devoted his entire life to bridging the gap between Jews, religious and non-religious, different parties, building up Eretz Yisrael. And now he's the object of derision. Davar, one of the Israeli newspapers, published a newspaper essay about this, and they had a picture of Rav Kook and on top of the picture was, Eile Rabbanecha Yisrael. That's a phrase which is borrowed from the Torah when they worship the Egel, worship the golden calf, they said, Eile Elohecha Yisrael, these are your gods, O Jerusalem. Makro Kuk, Eile Rabbanecha, these are your rabbis, O Israel. But Rav Kook, we'll see later, wrote a response. Stavsky was not a from Jew. Stavsky was not a Talmud of Rav Kook. Stavsky had never actually previously met Rav Kook. It's hard to say he didn't hear of him. Rav Kook was well known, but Stavsky was a secular Jew. By no means a Shomer Shabbos, anything. Secular Jew. Stavsky wrote a letter to Rav Kook from prison. In Yiddish, that was the language he spoke. I am a plain Jew, and I wonder why I have merited that Rav Kook concerned himself so much with my faith. I ask only, Rav Kook, that you continue to remember me in your prayers. My suffering is made easier by the knowledge that none other than you, Rav Kook, looks after me and remembers me when praying to God. May God protect his people. As we said before, the appeals process worked. Stavsky was released. And when Stavsky was released, and it was Erev Shabbos, Erev Tisha B'Av, 1934, Stavsky's supporters brought him straight to Yeshiva Merkaz Rav Kook. Not where the yeshiva is today, but the building, America's Rav Kook, one center of the old Yerushalayim. They brought Stavsky there, where he thanked Rav Kook for his efforts. At Rav Kook's suggestion, Stavsky was accompanied by a couple of Rav Kook's Talmidim for the first time in his life to the Kosel HaMaravi, where he davened and thanked HaKadosh Baruch Hu and so on. Zev Jabotinsky wrote to Rav Kook from Eretz Yisrael, Ha'am v'hanor lo yishkechu le'olam. As kolcha shegila mechadosh as guros hamasoros leivriyav. We'll always remember Rav Kook. You're raising your voice, the sake of Jews and Jewish tradition and so on. And again, as I said, this was Rav Kook's last major contribution. He died a little more than a year later. How was Rav Kook so sure? I mean, he said, "I know firsthand. I'm sure." It's a big question. Some say, and I think it's insulting to Rav Kook to say this. But some say that Rav Kook was naive in the sense that he couldn't imagine that a Jew would kill another Jew. We've spoken today, exiled Jew versus Jew. Rav Kook was well aware of the history of the Jews. Rav Kook was well aware of Tanakh. I think it insults Rav Kook's intelligence to say that his decision was based because he simply couldn't bring himself to imagine that a Jew could have committed this murder. What was the real reason? They asked the Tzvi Yehuda Kook, his son, and he quoted the pasuk, "Sod Hashem li Rayav." Kadosh Baruch Hu sometimes reveals secrets to those who fear him. Rav Kook was a Kabbalist, a mystic as well. Perhaps, most likely, Rav Kook had a lot of connections, including in the British government. Apparently, you know, if Rav Kook would have believed that no Jew could do it, why was he silent for almost a full year? And if his thing was based on other, you know, why did he wait till then? Apparently, right around then, Rav Kook got word, that's the theory, from some Talmidim of his who were involved with British intelligence, with British government and so on, who were on the inside, and they had information. It turns out that there were Arabs, two Arabs, who were arrested for the crime, one of whom admitted that he pulled the trigger. Then he recanted, he said he was surprised into saying it. Of course, it was in the British interest to have Jew versus Jew. That's why they didn't publicize the fact that they had an Arab in prison who confessed to killing Arlozorov. Remember, the wife of Arlozorov was there, but their memory was there. First thought that had been described, and the description didn't match Stavsky. So most likely, Rav Kook had, of course, he couldn't reveal the source, because he had Talmidim and associates who were inside British intelligence, you know, you don't just go and spill the beans, and he couldn't reveal the source. But that's most likely. There's an interesting, significant postscript to the story, and you'll see how it relates, really, to the Jew versus Jew today. In Eretz Yisrael, fascinating. This, of course, is not in the regular history books. From 1934, when he was released from prison, till 1948, Avraham Stavsky, Avrasha Stavsky, was responsible for saving thousands of Jewish lives. Ben Hecht, you've heard of Ben Hecht, the author, playwright, lived on a perfidy, that's one of the other books. This book is called A Child of the Century. So Ben Hecht was, you know, a supporter of the Irgun and the what's called the more radical movement, and you know, he had a lot of interesting things to say in general. But Ben Hecht writes of hearing for the first time about this guy Stavsky. This conversation is between Ben Hecht and Peter Bergson. Now, Peter Bergson wasn't his real name; his real name was Hillel Kook, the nephew of Kook. But he was an activist, you know, overseas and trying to get support for the, you know, it wasn't yet the state of Israel and so on. Anyway, he says as follows. Bergson said, in 19, I'm quoting now from this book, A Child of the Century, page 574. In 1938, the Irgun received secret information of a pact to keep the Jews out of Palestine. It was then we began to smuggle Jews out of Europe. Avraham Shostovsky was in charge of the operation. Who was Avraham Shostovsky? I asked. This is Ben Hef talking. Pleased by the name. The greatest human being I know, Peter uttered a rare chuckle. You will meet him sometime. He's like a hero out of Conrad or Gogol. He's a Taras Bulba of the Jews, 6 feet 3 inches tall, the best sailor on the Mediterranean, and he can throw 5 men out of a window in a fight. He's afraid of nothing, and also he can drink more than anybody I know. What's he doing now? I asked. Saving Jews, said Peter. Do you remember the free city of Danzig? Avrosha took 1,500 Jews out of it, piled them into some sort of leaky boat, and sailed it almost single-handedly to Tel Aviv. He's been doing the same thing ever since. That's who Avraham Shostovsky was. A little bit later, we have Ben Hef met Shostovsky, and he records that meeting here. This is just to read one other thing before I get to his meeting, speaking about what Shostovsky had to do. Shostovsky was now loaded, page 586, same book, A Child of the Century of Ben Hef. Shostovsky was now loading his cargoes in Marseille and other French ports. The cargoes were larger but always the same, Jews. The trickle of Jews able to get out of the German extermination zone. Shostovsky's work had become more difficult. His leaky tubs jammed with Jewish refugees must now outwit the Royal British Navy guarding the coast of Palestine against, quote, enemies of the British crown. Shostovsky and his death-haunted Jews heading for their holy land came under this classification, enemies of the British crown. Armed to the teeth, British land forces also guarded all the landing points on the Palestinian coast. But Shostovsky brought his cargoes in. He sailed them in under cover of fog and tempest. And when British batteries opened up on Shostovsky's tossing shadowy targets, our Shostovsky offered no answering shot. But he knew every shoal and reef off the Palestinian coast, and he would race the British Navy for a storm-whipped line of rocks, wreck his tub on them, and swim and wade his cargo to the shore of the Holy Land. Here, despite British land patrols, Irgunis whisked the seasick, sea-battered refugees to safety in the Hebrew settlements. And Shostovsky would head back from Marseille. How? God knows. Several times he remained afloat off the coast on a piece of timber, enjoying the lights of Tel Aviv from afar, until picked up by another Irgun tug. But back he always went, and back to Palestine he always came again with a new cargo. And finally, when Ben Hef met Shostovsky, Ben Hef was not afraid to speak up or speak his mind. He's meeting him now for the first time. Did you kill our Lazarus? I asked my tall guest. No, said Shostovsky, I have never killed a Jew. It was growing dark and we went into the house. Shostovsky walked up and down in my room, making it look small. I had looked forward for years to hearing Shostovsky's stories, but I was not disappointed when he failed to start even a single one of them. You didn't need to hear Shostovsky talk. The 20,000 Jews he had somehow pulled out of the German ovens and taken to Palestine seemed to speak for him. From the crowded decks of the Shostovsky fleet, and what a fleet it had been, limping tubs, discarded bottoms, riff-raff hulls with engine rooms steaming like Turkish baths. I'd read some of their fine names, for all ships, however foolish, cling to proud names, the Artemis, Star of Panama, and so on. For 15 years, Shostovsky had worked like some Jewish St. Christopher, ferrying the unexterminated Jews to Palestine, on boats, on rafts, on his broad back. Look at him closely now and you could still feel his passengers watching him. Not the tempest roaring around them, or the British warship firing on them, or the shadows moving in the water that might be mine, but always Shostovsky. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in 1933 and 1934, had different plans for Shostovsky, rather than having died at the end of a British rope in a prison for a crime that he didn't commit. In 1947, Shostovsky came to New York and rented an office on Madison Avenue where he founded what is known as the Three Star Line, a shipping company which served as a front for the Irgun. And with a group of his cohorts, he went to Bayonne, New Jersey, and he purchased a retired United States transport ship from the U.S. Navy, which transported tanks. He named the ship the Altalena. The Altalena was actually, Altalena was Jabotinsky's pen name. He named the ship the Altalena. On the Altalena, they loaded it up with, this is just after, or just in now 1948, okay, with weapons. Reading now from Menachem Begin's book, which we'll get back to in a second. 900 soldiers, 5,000 rifles, 4 million rounds of ammunition, 300 Bren guns, 150 Spandos, 5 Caterpillar track armored vehicles, thousands of air combat bombs, and other war equipment was loaded onto the Altalena. Now, the Altalena set sail from, originally from Bayonne, eventually to Marseille, or actually Virginia, then to Marseille, then on to Tel Aviv. Here the truth is murky. Menachem Begin writes in his book, The Revolt, that he had permission to land the Altalena in Tel Aviv. The Altalena arrived in June of 1948. The state of Israel was less than a month old. Remember, May of 1948, the state was established. Begin will claim, to his dying day, that he was bringing in weapons to assist the Haganah, because as you all know, immediately after the state of Israel was established, all the neighboring Arab lands declared war, and the Jewish armies were frightfully under-armed and undermanned. So here was a ship, the Altalena, coming in with the weapons I just read to you to help the cause. On the other hand, Ben-Gurion claimed to his dying day, and we have no, there's no way, unless someone was there to know what the truth is, Ben-Gurion claimed to his dying day that this was an attempted, I guess, a coup, that, you know, the Altalena was going to come in with the Irgun soldiers, and they were going to overthrow this fledgling new government and start, you know, start anew. Again, Jew versus Jew. Well, where the truth lies, I don't know. However, what we do know is that again, Begin claims, you can read it, that there was permission to land this ship. When it got into the borders off of Tel Aviv, and there's a whole section here on the Altalena, got into the waters of Tel Aviv, they were told to wait. They were given the impression that boats were going to come. They anchored a couple hundred yards offshore. The boats were going to come and bring the weapons in and bring the people in and so on. But there was some kind of delay. And the next thing anybody knew, when the Haganah soldiers arrived on the coast of Tel Aviv, within sight of the Altalena, they opened fire on the ship. This is after some of the weapons had been taken off. The ship eventually burnt and sunk. This is the famous Altalena affair. Menachem Begin was on that ship. Menachem Begin initially did not want to abandon the ship, but those who remember Menachem Begin know he was a little man, and his followers didn't give him the choice. They grabbed him and jumped overboard with him. Begin swam to shore. Avraham Stavsky was on that ship, and he died on the ship. 15 years after being acquitted for the murder of Arlozorov, and after saving 20,000 Jews, Arlozorov was killed by Jewish bullets. Jewish bullets, just off the coast of Tel Aviv. The story is that Ben-Gurion ordered that the Altalena be fired on once he heard that Stavsky was on the ship, because he never forgave Stavsky for what he thought was the murder of Arlozorov. Yigal Yadin was the chief of staff at that time. Now, when he got the orders to fire on a Jewish ship, he was a clever fellow. He said he's not accepting these orders once he gets them in writing. He's not going to take the fall for this. But in the bit of irony of history, along the chain of command closer to the actual firing, I'm not saying he pulled the gun, pulled the trigger, but was a young leader of the Haganah by the name of Yitzhak Rabin. And again, in the irony of history, Chaim Arlozorov was shot to death on the coast of Tel Aviv, died shortly thereafter in a Tel Aviv hospital. Avraham Stavsky was shot to death off the coast of Tel Aviv and died shortly thereafter in a Tel Aviv hospital. Yitzhak Rabin was shot to death by the coast of Tel Aviv and died shortly thereafter in a Tel Aviv hospital. This is Jew versus Jew, right? The Irgun had their approach, the Haganah had their approach, the Zionist Labor Party, the Zionist Revisionist Party, but this is what happens when it becomes violent, when there's lack of tolerance, and there's lack of communication sometimes. And Begin writes, it's an irony of history that happened. The ship was late in coming. Had it come, you know, a month earlier, it would have been different. It was perhaps Begin's greatest moment. And my son told me, and didn't reach him before Tisha B'Av, but he says that somewhere in this book, Begin himself says that this was his greatest moment. I was unable to find that. But it was certainly one of Begin's greatest moments. After the Alta Elena, Begin said, there will be no civil war. We are going to move past this. Not save the state of Israel at that time. I read you now from what Begin does write. On that night in 1948, when Alta Elena was destroyed, I spoke over the radio about the ship, its arms, and its dead. I was moved to tears. And there were mighty heroes of all classes who listened to me from their armchairs and jeered at my soft emotionalism. Let them jeer. There are tears of which no man need be ashamed. There are tears of which a man may be proud. Tears do not come only from the eyes. Sometimes they well up, like blood from the heart. They are tears that spring from sorrow, and they are tears that bring salvation. Whoever has followed my story knows that fate has not pampered me. From my earliest youth, I have known hunger and been acquainted with sorrow. And often death has brooded over me, both in the homeland and on alien soil. But for such things I have never wept. Only on the night when the state was proclaimed, and on the night of the Alta Elena. Truly, there are tears of salvation as well as tears of grief. There are times when the choice is between blood and tears. Sometimes, as our revolt against the oppressor has taught us, it is essential that blood should take the place of tears. And sometimes, as the Alta Elena taught us, it is essential that tears should take the place of blood. This should be remembered, particularly by those who shelled the Alta Elena and killed its men and shot at those, including the wounded men, escaping from its flames. Let them not boast in their hearts of that which somebody urged them to do, nor excuse themselves of his responsibility. Let them remember everything that is to be remembered, beginning with the secret hatching of the plot and ending with the last shell they fired into the burning and bleeding ship. If they remember this, perhaps they will understand the feeling of the man whose life they tried to take, as Begin was a target. And possibly they may understand that sometimes it is better that one man should pour tears from his heart over an abomination committed in Israel than that many, many should weep over its consequences. And that's what Begin is saying. We're not retaliating. There's not going to be more bloodshed. It's not going to be Jew versus Jew further. And so it came to pass, writes Begin, that there was no fratricidal war in Israel to destroy the Jewish state before it was properly born. In spite of everything, there was no civil war. Certainly, again, one of Begin's greatest moments. Stotsky, the tragedy of the story in Ben Hecht's book, you know, it records that he told that night as he was preparing to land, he said he'd gone back home to his mother in Israel, and of course he never made it. I thought about it later, Eddie, you know, in more recent times, in all of our lifetimes. So again, one of the great tragedies that we saw, again with different sides and different perspectives, the surrendering of Gush Katif, and there's a lot to say about that also, and I know the hour is late. Certainly, we know the sorrow experienced. One of the most moving pictures I saw in the wake of the Gush Katif tragedy was when they were emptying out the shuls. Somebody juxtaposed a picture of two young boys carrying the menorah out from the shul with the famous picture of the fresco and the Arch of Titus, where we've all seen pictures out of where the Romans took the menorah out of Yerushalayim, and this is carved into the Arch of Titus in Rome to this day. On the other hand, you know, despite the nostalgia, I think, which many people, including people living in Gush Katif, with which they look back on their lives there, in a matter of a couple of years, 150 Jews were killed there. Okay, and they were subjected to the barrage of rocket attacks and Qassam attacks at closer distance than in Sderot. Jew versus Jew, we can have different opinions, but it can't become violent and it can't become bloody. We see the consequences. There's a lot today, again, you know, the history with the Likud and the Labor Party and different approaches and different, that goes back to Arlozorov and goes back to Ben-Gurion and goes back to Begin. You know, this is all part of the same picture. I just want to end, and I think it would be appropriate to end with, I have here a copy of the response that Rav Kook wrote when criticized for the stance that he took. This is from Amari Hara'iyah. I read in the Hebrew and translate into the English, you know, phrase by phrase, and contains perhaps a lesson on what to do to avoid this type of gullus. Mimakor Levavi, from the depths of my heart, pained by the tribulation of my people, I respond to your letter. שאני מאיר עלי שמיים ואורץ שחיבוסי היא גדולה ממש בכל לבבי ובכל נפשי לכלל עמנו ולפרטיהם לכל מפודוסיהם. I adduce heaven and earth as my witness to my unqualified love with all my heart and all my soul of the Jewish nation as a whole and of every Jew regardless of his political affiliation. מפני שאני מאמין באמונה שלמה, I believe with perfect faith, perfect conviction, שכל חלק מהם הוא עבר מיוחד לשיר הקום הקדוש והנפלא שימי ושביל מסרדית, אני פרלי גודל מסרדית, שכל חלק מהם הוא עבר מיוחד לשיר הקום הקדוש והנפלא שכנסת ישראל כולה במלוא מובנה. Every Jew is a limb, a unique limb, a part of that sacred and awesome body known as Knesset Yisrael, the community of Israel, in its fullest sense. Kol avodah v'chol pulah, ki achumarit aruchanit, שמכשירה באופן קרוב או גם באופן רחוק את כינוס גלויותינו ושיבת בנינו לארצנו היא חביבה עלי חיבת נשמה לאין קץ. Every act and every deed, whether mundane or spiritual in nature, whether directly or which directly or indirectly prepares the way for the ingathering of the exiles and the return of the Jewish youth to our land, is as dear to me as my own soul. He then goes on to say again to repeat how he's clear to him. He has no doubt, emes, barurli, emes, betarata, imeiratinai, that I know that the accused is innocent, and so on and so forth. But at the end, he makes a very powerful comment, which would do us all good to hear and to emulate. B'chol si'ah, u'b'chol tnu'ah, yeshnam v'adai dvarim she'eini achol laskim aleihem. In every political party, in every movement, there are matters with which I disagree. Avos zeloyo chali grom she'avaki melayat ha'shalhevet el'kedet bi'il ha'meinu ha'kadosh u'l'chol pratav t'yeh nifgenet afil k'chut ha'sa'ara. This in no way impairs my boundless and burning love for our holy nation and its various parts. Listen to this. Et kulam ani ohev v'lo mitzarim. I love all Jews equally. B'midah shaveh l'nchubadai u'lebozai. I love all Jews equally, whether they revere me or despise me. I love them all with a boundless love. Such is my heart's response, dear friend, which I transmit to you, respectfully and loyally, Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. What Cook tells us is there can be disagreements and there can be different approaches. Rav Cook truly loved every single Jew. He says whether they revere me or whether they despise me, and he recognized the contributions that different Jews make, whether he agrees or disagrees with their politics or with their methodology. That's the Ahavas Yisrael of Rav Kook. And as we focus on Jew versus Jew, exile in Eretz Yisrael, the solution is to emulate the approach of Rav Kook and to have love for those with whom we disagree, and then al kol panim, the exile that we have will not be an exile of Jew versus Jew.